Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for Sunday the 17th. We're going to try something novel this week. We're actually going to be able to hear, unlike last week, the first part of the show. Don't know if y'all are getting the feedback noise, but the depot was louder than I've ever heard it. But nevertheless, welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everybody.
And welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Yes, good event, but Catherine, I don't know if all that came through last week, but we ended up getting good guests by the end of the show, so hopefully it was all worth it.
Yeah, and I wanted to let everybody know that David Poitras, I got a email from his campaign manager like Monday or Tuesday saying that he just didn't understand, he couldn't really hear, and he'd love to be back on the show, so...
And I'm sure we'll have him back.
Yeah, he did not mean to, like, hang up on us or, you know, disappoint any of you, any listeners. It was just a question of not understanding, not knowing what was going on and not being able to hear.
Oh, certainly.
Catherine, I was going to say at the beginning of the thing, there were, like, what, David, 1,000 people in the room? And at 7, right at 7 o'clock when General Poitras got on there, everybody was still there, unlike late in the show when people were leaving and we could actually hear. And he was trying to stand in another room, but it was hopeless at that point. I'm surprised you could hear us.
It was tough. I could hear you better than I could hear David. I think everybody.
Well, I have a big mouth, so, you know.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, we're going to have a good show anyway, and it's just going to be us sitting around so we can hear real good since we have plenty of guests. And we've got some new things. One, we're going to talk about things that are topical all around the South and the political world. Also, we're going to unveil what we feel is the rankings of Southern states and how politically hot they are, from the most political hotbed races in all the states to the least. We're actually going to start out at the bottom. We're going to do that a little bit, but... The topic that seems to be on everybody's mind is actually not in the South, and that is the Senate race this Tuesday to replace Senator Kennedy. Martha Coakley, who I believe, was she Attorney General or is a sitting Attorney General?
Right,
correct?
Yeah. Right.
Right. And yep. Then she's running against Scott Brown, and I don't really know Scott Brown's background, but he appears to be a little more of a moderate Republican for you know, American Republican standards, but then among Massachusetts Republican standards, he may not be that moderate. That seems to be a big, you know, campaign theme, if you will. But the thing is you would pretty much think Massachusetts Democrat slam dunk, but there's some conflicting polls, and I don't think you could use any of those polls to consider this a slam dunk. Tim, what do you think?
Well, the last three polls issued Friday, Saturday, Sunday all have Brown in the lead, anywhere from 3 to 15 points. I think all the momentum is with him or has been. She has run a very uninspired campaign. Democrats outnumber Republicans in that state 3 to 1. But she just hasn't got them motivated to go out to vote. And nearly 20% of the Democrats there say they're going to vote for him. A close race really, you know, don't mean much to me if we win. A loss would be devastating. It's Ted Kennedy's seat. And if it's lost, I mean, what's safe?
I mean, that's to me the biggest thing. Catherine?
I think she's going to pull it out. I think that when it comes right down to it on Tuesday, people are going to say, wait a minute, we can't let Senator Kennedy's seat go to a Republican.
I get the sense that she's going to pull it out. Although if it's this much work and this much trouble and you have to put this many resources into holding it, it really doesn't create a good picture for other places, particularly like our region, to you know, figuring out how to win seats other places that are much more of a toss-up. And really, I'm sure the DSCC, the DNC, they're having to expend a lot of resources and, in some cases, political capital they probably never thought they'd have to.
David, do you think it's fair to compare, you know, that particular race to the South, which is, you know, the most Republican region of the country? I mean, don't you think, regardless of what happens in that seat, we're going to have a tough time down here in November?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. This is the key question, though. Is Martha Coakley a good candidate, an average candidate, or a bad candidate?
I think that's the important question, is that, is this really about Democrats, or is it just about a good candidate versus a better candidate, or a fair candidate versus a adequate, you know, Brown, you know, I don't agree with him on anything, but he's, you know, kind of the picture of a good candidate. He's a, you know, JAG, lieutenant colonel in a JAG, and he's, you know, he's a hometown boy. He's been there, you know, in Massachusetts for a long time. So, and he's got, you know, the, you know, perfect little family and everything. I'm just looking at his website right now. And Coakley has had some problems. She hasn't, her message hasn't been very clear and or concise. So I think it's important to remember that there's a lot to be said about candidates versus seats and parties.
Yeah, I mean, I did see, the one thing I did pick up on other than the polling numbers, which have just been ad nauseum, was that she said something like, Curt Schilling was a Yankees fan, and if you're not familiar with baseball, he apparently, he was the pitcher that really helped the Boston Red Sox win the World Series, and he's a sports hero, even among people that don't agree with his politics, because he's a conservative Republican. But it's like, and it just made no sense, and it sounded strange, and she took a ton of flack for it, and this was after her poll numbers were crappy. I thought that was kind of said, maybe she's a bad candidate, although I would playing devil's advocate, say in places like our region, there's a whole lot of bad Republicans winning elected office. Just
well, you're absolutely right about that.
And so you would think a bad Democrat could win.
Well, now remember, if it were in November when more people were going to come out to vote, or if it were in 08 during no problem. But this is a special election. What's the three main ingredients of a special election? Turnout, turnout, and turnout. These people, these teabaggers, they are spitting nails. They are going to crawl over broken glass to get to the polls. Secondly, she's losing independents, and Democrats are losing independents all over the country. We're not losing these races in the polls because of Republican voters, we're losing them because of independent voters. What are 50% of the voters in Massachusetts? They're independent voters. So
they're
usually
the most Democrat, though. And I want to say a little bit of, I feel like I'm fixing to say an oxymoron, but how many teabaggers are there really in Massachusetts? Of course,
what they have provided for him is money, David. In just in a 24-hour period, they raised $1.3 million for him.
Yes, and so, I mean, that is true outside the state. I mean, I know they're doing phone banking outside of Massachusetts for Martha Coakley. I'm sure they're doing it on the other side for Scott Brown. But, I mean, it seems like it's not a good bellwether. Although, I mean, if you want to play devil's advocate, we can point to just, a 6 weeks ago or so where Democrats won in New York 23, see, there's no, Democrats apparently had no business winning, according to the pundits. And then I think y'all were telling me about a race in Virginia, even though it was further down the ballot that voted well. Tim or Catherine, jump in and tell us.
It was a state senate seat in Northern Virginia.
Right.
It was a
Republican seat.
Deal.
Yeah, and the Republican that had held it was elected maybe the state's attorney general or something like that in November. And the state was kind of a swing district anyway, up near the Washington, D.C., so it presented a great opportunity, and we pulled off the upset there.
But it's certainly, if you were saying, hey, Virginia's trending this way, and then Democrats won it, you'd be like, eh, that's not that big a deal. But given that, you know, all momentum had seemed to gone away, and Democrats lost everything in November, and, you know, Virginia was going from purple back to red, then to win this makes you think, huh, maybe the map will be a little more complex than it looks.
And one more important thing about that state Senate seat, people would say, well, it's not that important. But in Virginia, there are only 40 members of the state Senate. Democrats led 21-19. There was talk of the new incoming governor trying to either appoint some Democratic state senators in swing districts to state jobs to open those seats up or trying to get them to switch outright. Now it becomes 22-18, and that one swing difference really will help the Democrats to hold the state Senate, and we need to do that because redistricting is coming up.
Exactly. Yes, and it's funny, the playbook you're talking about appointing Democrats to offices, isn't that exactly what the governor, is it Blackshear in Kentucky, has done
right.
So artfully the other way around. He's a Democrat appointing Republicans, and then in certain districts where then those have ended up, some of those seats have been filled by Democrats, and it's made the legislature more
Democratic.
Now the
game's played.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's just saying, hey, look what they did one state over in Kentucky, and let's do some of that the other way. You know, it's an interesting tactic. I guess if nothing else, it'll make the government itself more bipartisan. I mean, it's what Sonny Perdue, frankly, probably should have thought about doing on the Secretary of State job, not necessarily appointing a sitting Democrat, but maybe a Democrat that was maybe 70-plus years old, knew something about election law, and had no intent on running again. It would have made him look a little more bipartisan. But
that's not Sonny's M.O.,
yeah,
though,
yeah,
David.
Yeah, Sonny doesn't
not
do that.
All. Yeah, we'll get to Sonny later, but that, I was just kind of thinking of that. Well, I think it's time to go ahead and start our you know, hottest states in the South rankings, and hopefully some of the people will pick up on this, and maybe this will start to create a conversation. But we're going to go coldest to hottest, if you will. And, of course, if people disagree, you know, they can call in and tell us what they think. But I believe the consensus was that there were two states that were kind of cold together, but Virginia, we had ranked at the bottom, and that was because they have no state, they have no U.S. Senate seats and no gubernatorial seats coming up for the next almost 4 years, at least on the gubernatorial seats. So they just don't have any elections. It's still a good political environment, but you have to have, you know, play the game, if you will, to get ranked a little higher. Tim, any thoughts on that? I think you thought Virginia might be a little higher. Just based on some
well,
of these things like you were talking about.
I had it right next to the bottom, and the reason is, was, you know, of course, next year all the state legislative races are in Virginia, the state Senate and the House of Delegates. Pretty close divide in both houses where, you know, a swing of three or four seats could give, like, total power to the Republicans. Or, you know, keep it split, Senate for Democrats and House delegates or whatever for Republicans, or give it all to Democrats. And that would become very important in two ways because Virginia now has a Republican governor, and whereas they did have a Democratic governor, and also for redistricting. So that's why I put Virginia above Tennessee.
Oh, okay, because you had – we'll get into that in just a second. Because the one that I kind of debated with on could have been last, Mississippi, and that's number 11 in our ranking. Mississippi, once again, both U.S. Senate seats were just decided. They're not going to have a U.S. Senate election this time. Their gubernatorial election won't come up until 2011, which is 2 years before Virginia. That's why they got the one spot up. I guess the key race in Mississippi is going to be – Travis Childers running to hold on to his congressional seat, but I don't really think that's going to be that much of a race. I think Travis Childers is pretty popular in his district. What sense do you get on that, Catherine?
I tend to agree with you, and I think that there's not going to be a lot of attention on Mississippi in the coming year. I think it's going to be you know, sort of a, you know, we're just not going to be paying that much attention to it. I think with Georgia and Kentucky and South and North Carolina, I think there's going to be plenty, and Florida, there's going to be plenty.
Every other state in the South.
Yeah, there's going to be plenty of attention, plenty of time to spend on other states. I think Mississippi's going to get a little bit of a free ride this time.
Yes, and I guess one good, you know, we have listeners in Mississippi, and we've had callers from Mississippi, but just so you'll know, probably if we did this ranking a year from now, Mississippi would skyrocket to the top because it would have the next gubernatorial election.
Exactly.
So, have, you know, I guess Louisiana would also have theirs. So never fret, Mississippi. You have hope. Just give the calendar a 10
Well, sometimes
months
it's not bad
long.
to be, you know, to not get that much attention.
Yes. Well, now we're into our top 10, and this is one where we had a little contention, but I think we ended up deciding to slot Tennessee at number 10. And what's funny about this is they are going to have a gubernatorial election, but and it's a Democratic-held seat. Phil Bredesen, you know, the former mayor of Nashville, held it for two terms. But I just don't get the sense that this is going to be a very good race, and you would think Democrats could really put up a fight here. Is that the sense you get, Tim?
Nope. that's why I had Tennessee at the bottom. I'm in pretty good constant contact with some people up there. I think the reason I don't rate it as hot as all, I think the election cycle is going to be pretty one-sided up there this time. I think they're trending very red, and I think we're going to get smoked across that state. I hate to say that, but, you know.
And really what's crazy is probably if you looked at the politicians in Tennessee that could, you know, somehow win office, you would think Harold Ford Jr. would have a chance to win in Tennessee, but instead he's taken his ball and moved up to New York and running in a race that we really don't need another candidate in. Right, Catherine?
Yeah, I think I agree with y'all.
I mean, if he stayed in Tennessee and possibly ran for governor there, that might be an interesting race and would put them up. Or even if he stayed and just laid the groundwork for running against Corker in two more years.
I don't think so. I think he's much – I mean, I don't think he should run for Senate in New York, but I think he should just go and make a bunch of money from the banks.
Well, I mean, I think he's peed away the opportunity around running Tennessee – because the carpetbagger argument Harold can't decide where he lives, would be hung around his neck, and
yeah.
It would probably be much more effective than the Call Me Harold commercials were, honestly. You know, so that's gone and done. But and then, you know, even if, you know, I don't think Al Gore would reenter the political scene with his name on the ballot, but then if he were to get involved in some big way in trying to grow and groom some new candidates in some fashion, even that would help the, you know, cause in Tennessee, if you will. But we just don't see Tennessee at this point. And I will say, we're going to do this periodically, these rankings. So things change. So Tennessee Democrats, you know, change the dynamics, and you can move up. But moving up to the next number 9, and I had a lot of this memorized, but not all. 8 and 9 were pretty interchangeable. But number 9, we have Alabama. They do have a governor's race. It does have an interesting primary on both sides, so that will be worth watching. The trick for me is saying, in the general, does the Democratic Party have a great chance at winning? Tim, what do you think?
Well, look, you know what I think about Alabama? The race that is going to overshadow all is a congressional race, because we had a party switcher there.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And there is going to be a great deal of national attention paid to it, and there's going to be a lot of national money pour into that race. Look, if the Republicans are going to win anything this coming year that is really meaningful, it would be the House. They need to win 40 seats to do that. One thing they got to do is hold this seat of this party switcher And the first thing you got to watch is the primary there. Oh, it's going to be a huge thing with Griffith there. If you know that, I think that's going to be one of the biggest races in the country.
Honestly, if we were just looking at primary elections, you could make a case for Alabama being as high as number three. When you throw
the November
election date in it, that's what moves them down, because I think the Democratic primary is fascinating for governor with Artur Davis, you know, a very sharp guy, and then Roy Sparks, kind of a grassroots Democrat. They brought in the health care debate in a progressive fashion, which is, you know, kind of unusual for Alabama. You know, that's interesting, but then can one of those candidates take it and win the whole thing? If the polls start to tighten up, you know, Friends of Public Policy polling show us a tighter poll, Alabama's sure to move up. But right now they're at number nine. And then number eight, Georgia. We are going to have a gubernatorial election here. We are going to have a Senate election, we guess. I mean, we have to have, you know, two real campaigns to have that. I mean, we have on the ballot, we have the makings of more, but right now it's been pretty ho-hum. Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty ho-hum.
I mean, can we make a case for moving Georgia up? I really don't think we can.
Well, of course, you know, it's always higher in our rankings because we live here. But if we
want to be objective, yeah.
Yeah, I think being objective, the only thing I'll say is that I do think that the right kind of looks at Georgia as the leader in, you know, taking back some of the state houses, because we did it, you know, we did it back in 2002, and we also have a lot of crazy legislation here that they sort of, I mean, Georgia's like the test water for a lot of, you know, right-wing legislation. So I think the right might view us in a little higher ranking just because they try everything here first. Not everything, but a lot of things they try here first. But
us in Texas are becoming two of the most Republican states there are.
Exactly.
As far as what's controlled.
And but yeah, I think that it's going to be a pretty ho-hum Senate race. I don't see, unless, you know, Peach Pundit again this week brought up the whole idea of Jane Kidd running, which is so crazy. But you know, I think the one candidate that I know of, RJ, while he's a, you know, certainly a talented young man and smart and capable, it doesn't look like he's getting much traction. And as much as I don't like him, a lot of people really like Johnny Isakson. They think he's more moderate than some of the other Southern senators. I don't see him that way, but I know a lot of people do.
Yeah, I mean, his voting record is pretty much right there with some of the others.
Yeah,
I just
exactly.
don't think he frames it the same way. Tim, tell us about Georgia number eight in the rankings.
Well, I mean, if the right's nervous about anything, and I'm not sold on why they are yet, it's the gubernatorial election. They're a little nervous about that. Personally, I think the high water mark for the Democratic candidate in the gubernatorial election is 47%, unless the Republicans hack each other up with chainsaws, which is a distinct possibility with some of that crowd they got over there.
I think basically Georgia Republicans, good dynamics, bad candidates.
Yeah. And about Johnny Isakson, I guess what people do is they compare him to Saxby Chambliss. Well, you know, I'm in that camp. Hey, Isakson's a great fellow. But, you know, his voting record is pretty conservative. But people that meet him, that know him, all tell me the very same thing, what a heck of a nice fella he is. You know what? That goes a long way in politics.
It goes a hell of a long way. You're absolutely right. That means a lot. And if he's out there meeting people, and because he has been, you know, I could think he was at the Wild Hog Supper. No, I think there's a lot to be said for that personal connection with a candidate. You can't say that enough, really.
Yep. And
yeah,
David, the congressional races in this state are just, they're all holes, I think. I mean,
I think
everyone
everybody that's currently in Congress. I'm sorry. Well, every party that currently holds a seat is going to hold a seat. The first Wednesday in November. I don't think any are going to switch. The ninth has a primary because we still have a Democratic candidate to fill Nathan Dill's seat, and we'll get to that more. But that has a little bit of interest. We'll also talk about the DeKalb-based seat. It has a little bit of a primary now, but nothing that's going to change the dynamics of, the House structure and Speaker of the House. Well, then let's move on to seven, and I really think, six and seven could be pretty interchangeable in a lot of ways. North Carolina, at this point, I rank number seven, and y'all didn't, protest too much, but North Carolina has a Senate seat where Richard Burr is running for reelection. He's not that popular, but once again, the dynamics may not allow the Democrats to make much of a race of it. I believe Elaine Marshall, the former Secretary of State's running, there may be other candidates. And the polling showed that it's a winnable seat for the Democrats if the trends fall the right way. Catherine?
I think it'll be interesting to watch what goes on in North Carolina. I think there's, some opportunities, but it's probably, I don't know. It's hard to say. It's always hard for me to look. I don't really have a good magic ball, so. Crystal ball.
Yeah, and there are some House seats. Larry Kissel and Heath Shuler, Blue Dog Democrats that hold conservative seats, and the Republicans are going to come hard after those, so those also give North Carolina a little more interest. Tim, your overall thoughts on North Carolina?
In any other year, Burr would lose. I mean, that's a gimme. If the economy improves, if the polling changes, the national mood changes, Burr will move into the top three or four endangered Republican incumbents in the country right now, though. With the dynamics of what's going on nationally, he's gonna win even with his approval rating.
Yeah, I mean he may already be one of the two or three most endangered Republicans, but then if the environment's right, that may be an oxymoron. I mean that would be like an endangered Democrat in 2008. I mean those animals just really didn't exist. So that kind of keeps it there, and it could change a little bit. We'll move into six, South Carolina. And it's kind of funny. I think had Mark Stanford not had this scandal, South Carolina would probably have been 2 to 3 spots lower.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that light got shined on South Carolina, it's got that, hotbed glow, if you will. Catherine, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to – all eyes are going to – not all eyes, but many eyes are going to be on South Carolina in the coming year just because, we want to find out what happens to Sanford and just, how the political fallout falls out with him and with everything else going on there. I think it'll be kind of nice. I always say it's kind of nice when the light's focused on South Carolina instead of Georgia, so.
At least negative light. If it's light of jobs coming to stuff, hey, bring them on.
Right.
Yes. Tim, your thoughts on South Carolina?
Yeah, not only is the Sanford soap opera, I guess you would have to refer to it as, making that state's gubernatorial election interesting, but South Carolina, a case can be made that it is one of the very most conservative states in the country, and with a heavy presence of the teabagger types, the Tea Party folks. I mean, there's been a couple of local Republican organizations that have condemned Lindsey Graham. So I won't. Not only do we need to watch the election in South Carolina, we need to watch the progress of these people going after folks like Graham that they don't consider conservative enough on some issues and how that's going to play out, because it could be a microcosm of what might happen in some of the Republican primaries in the spring and summer. If anything is going to derail the Republicans this year, I think it's going to be inter-party fighting.
Yes, speaking to that, I remember it was maybe as many as 10 years ago, there was a really religious conservative group, homeschooler types, you know, ultra-conservative, and they all had a meeting, and they were kind of from, you know, different parts of the country, and they had this idea that they would all move to one state and try to take over that state. And one thing they said is, you know, if we could find a state that was already pretty conservative, then maybe that would be the place to move. I guess, Catherine, you can figure out what state that was.
No, what state was it?
It was South Carolina.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
I guess you look at the history and you say, okay, what state has pulled out of the United States first because they weren't conservative enough to start slavery or allow slavery? Or keep slavery. That was South Carolina. And it just kind of goes, you know, historically, that South Carolina, one of the most conservative states, and Tim's right about that, watching that. Also, there is a congressional seat, which could be key if the House comes close. Henry Brown, who had a little trouble in South Carolina 1, has decided to retire, and so that could be a pickup opportunity for Democrats. And if it gets real tight, picking up a few Republican seats might help the Democrats hold the House. So that's kind of a secondary thing to watch. In that state. Then I guess, are we to the top five already? Top five, these are some states that most of them have multiple races, or they have races that are just really pivotal in the holding of the Senate, holding of the House, or governor's races. And number five, Louisiana. And I don't know if y'all have ever seen the movie the documentary Louisiana Boys Raised on Politics, but, you know, Louisiana is the most colorful states in political history, and it's pretty much, I mean, if they're holding elections, they're top five, aren't they, Tim?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so this year they have David Bitter, a guy that shouldn't even run. He should be too ashamed, but he's running anyway. And Charlie Malasaw, a top-line recruit, especially in a year like this, is seeking that office. That's pretty much where your races start, Tim.
Yeah, it does. And again, I would put Bitter in there with Burr. Any other year, boy, we got him. But not this year, not so far. I really want to see the stripper stay in the Republican primary against Bitter. That'll be a lot of fun for a lot of reasons. Secondly, if there's a House seat we're going to pick up in this country, we're going to pick one up in New Orleans. I can say that Representative Chow down there in New Orleans, we're going to win that seat. That's ours. That's Jefferson's old seat. He's 25 points behind, and that's a done deal.
Yeah,
and there's
some
good candidates running, too. A couple of good Democrats running.
Yeah, was on the other week with us, and you're right about that seat being just – it's almost so easy to take, it almost hurts them in the rankings, but it's key, so it does. It has to help them. But to me, that Senate race is huge. And, Tim, I completely forgot about Stormy Daniels. I think we need to redo the rankings. If she does anything interesting, that might be number one now, you know. I mean, porn stars in politics, number one. Nah.
Yeah, especially with Bitter, you know. That's just too good. Yeah.
He might try to strike a deal. You know,
or get a date, yeah.
No, well, you know, strike a deal. I don't mean a political deal. You know, I mean like Tiger Woods kind of deal. You know, that. Kind but yeah, so Louisiana is always one to watch. There may actually, you know, Representative Malasaw's district, Democrats have to hold that, and it was Republican held before Charlie Malasaw won that seat, and then. There's the Don Cashew seat. It was Republican, the Baton Rouge-based seat. Don Cashew won it in a special. Then he lost it in the general election. So in the past year, it's been held by both parties. That could be a seat that is in play. So a lot of different races in Louisiana. So it's probably going to keep top five rankings throughout the year. Number four, and this is one of the most contentious states when we discuss this, Kentucky. Tim, I'm going to let you lead off telling us why you think Kentucky should be four.
Well, actually, I thought it should be three, but, you know, that's just me. We have a very interesting situation developing up there, and it involves the fact, you know, that Senator Bunning was pretty much forced out of running again because his fundraising was dried up, compliments of his fellow Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, whose own approval ratings have kind of dropped in that state because a lot of conservatives thought that, you know, he was messing around in the other seat, shouldn't have done that, blah, 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 blah. Not that they didn't want Bunning gone. They wanted Bunning to arrive at that conclusion on his own. And you've got a very contentious race on both sides. It's going to be one of the most watched Senate races in the country. One guy that is emerged in the mix that people thought was going to be a joke was Dr. Rand Paul, Ron Paul's son. Well, this guy is a serious candidate, so serious that political ops up there are saying, and they told me and Catherine this, you know, on the show here, that if the election were today, Dr. Paul would beat the establishment candidate, Trey Grayson, and then would go on and win the general election. But it's not the slam dunk with Trey Grayson that it was supposed to be. There's a couple of strong Democratic candidates running, including one that you like very much, David. And you can get
the Attorney General.
Yeah, right. And so this is going to be one of the most watched races in the country this year, and that's why I personally think Kentucky is one of the, maybe one of the top five states in the country to watch for that race.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe the southern states will make a lot of the top five. We have it at four. You personally thought three. That primary with Rand Paul is really something to watch, and then because there are good Democrats, and Kentucky in the past has been more of a swing area. It seems like it's, you know, could go either way in November. And then on the congressional side, Ben Chandler has held his seat for a few terms, but it's more of a swing district. Also, the Louisville seat, the congressman that won that just won it this past time, so this will be the first time he's defended his seat, which means I'm sure the Republicans have targeted it. Catherine, your thoughts on Kentucky?
I think it's going to be really interesting to watch. You know, it's sort of because of its location, it's a southern state to many people, but some people think of it as a Midwestern state. So I think it's going to get a lot of attention. And I think, you know, they do have a pretty good Democratic Party there, I think, from what I can gather. So I think it'll be an interesting state to watch how they, you know, how they move their voters and how Dr. Paul does. I think that he's kind of a surprising entry into that race, and I was really surprised when we talked to those fellows from Kentucky a couple of weeks ago at, you know, how much confidence they had in his abilities. So I think it's going to be definitely a state to watch.
Yeah, I do think it's a state that one reason that I guess I'm not as high on it is because it was one of the few states that Democrats did better in 2004 than 2008, I think, along with Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Tennessee. And it's funny, you know, all those states kind of touch each other. They were the only four states in the nation where John Kerry did better than Barack Obama. So you have to say, was this a one-year anomaly somewhat based on race, or is this a new trend for Kentucky?
But
I think it is with Tennessee.
But look at the 2006 statewide elections in Kentucky. We really made some hay there.
Yeah,
and you know, I know the national picture what it is, but let's just take Kentucky by itself. The potential is there for some barn burner races.
It is, and so we'll keep watching it, polling data, and you know, it's likely to stay pretty high in the rankings throughout the year. Now getting into the top three, Arkansas.
number three. And I think there are other races, but the one race that gets her there is Blanche Lincoln Lambert. And she may, and now I guess she is just Blanche Lincoln. She's dropped Lambert, correct? She is possibly the most endangered, and well, second most, I guess Harry Reid's most, but the second most endangered incumbent. But she's a politician that's always been very popular in her state. So you have to wonder how accurate the polling is. But that's the number one thing. But then also there are some House races, including Vic Snyder, whose polling was so bad in recent weeks. He announced just at the end of the week that he's retiring. So that's now an open seat in a swing district at that. Catherine, your thoughts on Arkansas?
I have to be honest that I haven't paid as much attention to Arkansas as I perhaps could have. But, yeah, it looks like Blanche Lincoln is in some trouble, and hopefully she'll snap out of it.
Yeah, Catherine, people used to not pay much attention to Arkansas, and people like Bill and Hillary Clinton will run in the state. And I think since then I've learned my lesson. I know to, you know, not sleep
yeah,
on Arkansas.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and what's another thing that's kind of strange about Arkansas is it was so Democratic on the U.S. Senate side that the Republicans couldn't even find a candidate to run against Mark Pryor. And, you know, you have to think they're kicking themselves now for not finding a candidate. I don't think that candidate would have beaten Mark Pryor at all. But to me, there's not this big, you know, gaping hole in Blanche Lincoln's resume that's not there in Mark Pryor. I think they're both solid senators that are very – their voting records are probably within, you know, 2 or 3 points of each other. Tim, your thoughts on Arkansas?
Well, to show you the kind of trouble she's in, the Republicans didn't really field an A-list candidate. There's, I believe, 4 Republicans running. They're all from the school of who are these people. And they're running anywhere from 8 to 12 points ahead of her. What is really, really disturbing is she is stuck at 38-39% in every one of these polls, and she's not moving. She's in big trouble. Big trouble. We're gonna really have to watch this bad boy this year. She is in some trouble.
Yeah, Arkansas, if they had either another race or two, or they have better primaries, they can move up. But that's going to keep them from probably staying around number three at the highest. Getting to number two, and probably one of the first times this state would have been this high in many years, Texas. And Texas has both a gubernatorial election and it has a U.S. Senate election. One of those, the Governor Rick Perry is running for his third or fourth term at this point. I mean, this guy's just been there forever, but he's getting an inter-party challenge by the state senior senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, and he has a top-flight Democratic opponent now in Houston, our former Houston mayor Bill White. So that's pretty much to me a two-part race that's very competitive in both halves. Tim, agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree with you totally. Of course, Mayor White moving out of the Senate race didn't really leave us with much there.
Yeah.
And it looks like all the top flight candidates from both parties are in the gubernatorial race there. Also, we're going to get a peek at what goes on in Texas before a lot of other states, because if I'm not mistaken, their primary is coming up in March, right?
Yes, it comes up early, so now they'll have to work to hold their ranking. I will say this, you know, we talk about not having top flight candidates. John Sharp, who is the state comptroller and the state railroad commissioner, which is a pretty big office in Texas, and also he ran for governor in 98 and 2002. He is running for the Democratic nomination. It looks like he is the Democratic nominee at this point. Running for U.S. Senate. So, I mean, it looks like, you know, we've got a little bit of a candidate on the Democratic side. Strangely enough, there are 4 Libertarians running for the seat.
Wow.
You know, there's a slew of Republicans. But it'd be interesting to see what happens here. If, you know, if John Sharp can raise a little money, then you might have somebody to run for that U.S. Senate seat in addition to the gubernatorial race. And, you know, probably they'll kind of, you know, lift each other up. I think another thing, people are waiting to see if David Dewhurst, which is a lot of times is considered kind of a lightweight, who's their lieutenant governor, if he decides to run for U.S. Senate, probably this guy thought he could run for governor, but his man in front of him in his own party just can't seem to leave. But that'll be also another thing to watch on the Republican side, because I guess right now one of their top flight candidates is the state railroad commissioner.
They still have
Jones,
a railroad commissioner?
Name Jones. Yeah, they have a railroad commissioner. She's a young lady. I'm looking at her site. Yeah, it's apparently, you know, I guess it's much akin to Georgia's PSC, although I guess we think, hey, regulating natural gas, electricity, water, all those different things is kind of a job where it's watching the railroad tracks. But, you know, apparently it's a big industry in Texas, and it's a stepping stone that people have used to move up. And this lady's definitely running for U.S. Senate. She's got her sight. She's hunting deer and riding horses and visiting folks in hospital with babies and all kind of things. But anyway, so that's Texas, and so that's going to be interesting to watch. But, you know, in March, we're going to really see what happens, you know, comes out of there for the nomination, and then polling will start to see how close Bill White can get and if he can even take a lead, which I think is very possible on probably a Rick Perry, who a lot of people are kind of sick of. And then now number one, and I guess if you've been keeping score, you already know what it is, but Florida, number one seat. And there's a lot of races there. There's a U.S. Senate seat, a gubernatorial seat, and a good many congressional seats. But probably the one race that's getting it there is for basically the soul of the Republican Party. Can Marco Rubio defeat what many consider a moderate Republican sitting governor, Charlie Crist, and what will that race mean nationwide? Catherine?
I think it's going to be, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It's sort of the heart of the party. You know, who prevails will be an indicator for the upcoming, you know, short term in the Republican Party, I think.
Yeah, because, I mean, basically, if Marco Rubio wins this race, and then people say this guy is too conservative for Florida, and then that gives Kendrick Meek, who is pretty much, you know, the foregone conclusion, who will be the Democratic nominee, if it makes it where he can win this seat, then the Senate becomes a lot easier to hold for Democrats. Also,
right.
Another thing that's interesting is this is a state that has actually lost population in the last 2 years, and a state that's been gaining a lot of population. What is that demographic shift going to mean for politics in Florida?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah,
that is a good question. But you've already nailed the main story in Florida. It is a microcosm of a bigger battle that's going on in this country for the direction of the Republican Party, and Marco Rubio is what, the poster child of that. You know what? I think he's going to win.
I do.
I think he's going to beat Governor Crist. I think there is still a small chance that Governor Crist could change his mind and, you know, stay on as governor. But that's been amazing what has happened down there. Rubio's an energetic candidate. Of course, he'll play well with the Cuban-American community, who is historically Republican. So it'll be interesting to watch. And you mentioned some congressional seats, like Kendrick Meek's seat, for instance, is open. It'll be Democratic, of course, but there's, you know, a goodly number of Democrats running for that seat, so we need to watch all of that, too. Yeah, I agree with you, David, on ranking Florida number one in the South to watch.
Yeah, and then the governor's race, Alex Sink is a very popular elected official in the South, and it's, you know, she's the odds-on favorite to the chief financial officer to win that nomination, then can she take it, take the general, and I guess Bill McCollum, who's the sitting attorney general and who seemed to have run for everything lately. I think he ran for governor 1 year before and U.S. Senate. Lost a pretty close U.S. Senate seat just a few years ago, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, that'll be an interesting race to see because if, you know, Democrats take the governorship of Florida, I mean, that's a pretty large state population-wise. That'll affect redistricting in the future, which Florida, even though they lost population, I'm pretty sure they're scheduled to gain a seat from the population they picked up in the first 8 years of the, you know, 10-year period. But this is the wrong time, of course, to lose population with the census workers fixing to hit the ground any day and start counting heads, I guess pulling into other stuff. If you think about the Haiti crisis, probably the most Haitian immigrants already lived in Florida. That may mean that they get a little bit of a population boost around the Miami area there. And then, you know, there are Adam Putnam is going to resign or is not going to run for reelection in District 12. Don't know a ton about that seat, but there are Democrats and Republicans running. So there could be some competitive House seats. So right now I think Florida is number one, and I think they may stay there for a little while.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's our rankings, and I hope people, you know, respond and tell us what they think, and maybe this stuff will get posted some places to continue the
discussion. But we've got about 9 minutes, so I'm going to try to pull through some more topics pretty quick. And one that I just got to talk about, too much fun, is
a lot of media outlets are reporting that this year's Daytona 500 has invited Sarah Palin to be like a special guest, like a VIP appearance. I don't know if she's going to say, gentlemen, start your engines or wave a flag or what. But I was really surprised that NASCAR did this because even though their fan base may be rather conservative, I don't think that the NASCAR officials want to pigeonhole themselves into just one segment of the population. Tim, what do you think?
Well, she was invited there because she was already going to be there anyway in the area to speak to a local Chamber of Commerce luncheon. So like any celebrity, she just got an invitation. She's going to be introduced, you know, along with all the other luminaries that are in attendance, and there'll be quite a few, including probably every statewide candidate in the state there. But she's not going to say, thank God, gentlemen, start your engines. And I believe the NASCAR crowd will treat her like a rock star.
Oh,
yeah,
I
don't know. I mean, but I will say this. Now, she did drop the puck at a hockey game during the campaign, and this was early, right after she got picked,
before
a lot of the negative stuff had come out of her. And she got booed.
Dude, that was in Philadelphia, though.
It was, but it was a hockey crowd. You would think they might just respect the fact that she, like, thought their sport was number one, which is highly unusual for most Americans to think.
They booed Santa Claus in Philadelphia, David.
Okay,
they certainly booed Sarah Palin.
They booed their own teams in Philadelphia.
Go ahead, Catherine.
They boo their own teams in Philadelphia. Philadelphia has the worst sports. I mean, you know, Jerry, the guy I live with, he's from Philadelphia, and he always, like, cringes during those games. They are the worst fans.
Catherine, they're not the worst fans. They're the meanest fans.
Meanest fans, okay.
That's what they are, because I'll tell you what the worst fans are. That's that bunch I have to go sit at the Georgia Dome with. That's the worst bunch, because they don't even, you know, we can't even fill our stadium with our own fans, because we got a bunch of people that are turncoats. And don't get me started, we'll have a two-hour show. But then the one little thing I will tell y'all, is I went to wrestling back last April, and the person that received the loudest boos of anybody that evening was not Randy Orton or any of the other heel wrestlers that came out that night. They showed a little clip from the Tribute to the Troops where George Bush probably said five words, and he got booed lustily. And this is in 2000. This was 2009. This was after he was out of office, April 2009. So, you know, a lot of people consider, you know, NASCAR crowds and pro wrestling crowds to be somewhat interchangeable. I'm only in one of those two audiences, so I don't think it's completely interchangeable. But that's an interesting note to think about. So, you know, I probably won't watch the Daytona 500, but I will find out the reports of how people respond to Sarah. We got maybe two more topics, time for that. Let's talk about Georgia congressional races. This week we had one candidate jump out and two jump in, but different districts. But Mike Evans, the former transportation director of Georgia, and that's not an elected office, if our listeners are curious, he was set to run for Nathan Dill's seat, Georgia 9, and he decided he's not going to run for office. Tim, why did he not decide to run?
Well, he claims that his job is suffering. He's a real estate developer, and the way he talked, that if he continues to run full-time for Congress for the next few months, that it's going to hurt his budget, it's going to hurt his family, and I'm not, you know, sure how bad off he is or if he's just looking at the fact that he probably wasn't going to win anyway. His wife, you know, makes, depending on who you ask, anywhere from $125,000 to $175,000 a year, but she's going to lose that salary in 11 months, of course, when Sonny leaves office. But that's what he claims, David. So he's claiming financial hardship, so I don't know.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting to see what falls out there. I think, you know, he was more from the Gainesville side of that district. And you also Lee Hawkins, a state senator from that area, he's running, and so they were probably kind of dip into the same pool. And you also have Bill
Tom Fee. Graves is ain't Tom Graves from over there too?
Tom Graves is from the Alton side of the district, actually from Gordon County.
Okay.
So he kind of dips out of a different side. So really, he probably kind of hurts at this because a lot of those candidates on the eastern side of the district were probably the vote up, giving him the lion's share of the western side of the district. And if people aren't running from the east from the west, it'll be the east versus the west with one candidate, and that's not necessarily good for him. But so I still think Tom Graves is the front runner, but he's probably not as in a strong a position as he was. But that race, just looking at it, I mean, we're talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 announced Democrat. I'm sorry, Republican candidates. There's still some people rumored to be running. I kind of think some may be waiting another year for the district to kind of change up. You also have Eugene Moon, a conservative independent, running, and I can't believe this got by us. Mike Seaman, the Hall County Democratic chair, that is Gainesville. He's also an Episcopalian minister. He is going to run. I just found that out tonight. Mike, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the show sometime and give us a call for some other stuff, too, if you need to. So that's going to be interesting to watch. But, I mean, I have to think that raising money and being in Sonny Perdue's power structure, which he really was, Mike Evans had a chance there to make some hay, and he's jumping out. He's also one of the younger candidates from that eastern side of the district. And I guess then the other thing that got some interest is in Hank Johnson's 4th district, two Democrats announced this week that they're going to seek his office. Current county commissioner from DeKalb, Connie Stokes, is going to seek the seat. And a former county CEO and old friend of the Kudzu Vine,
Snuggles,
Jones, is going to look at that seat. Catherine, what do you think of that fourth congressional seat?
I think it's foolhardy for those people to be running it against Hank Johnson, and I think they're going to regret it. I think all Hank really has to do is stand on his record and show up to events. And I don't think he really even has to run against them. You know, he's got good committee appointments. He's got his voting record is really good, and it's a pure, it's such a pure Democratic district. I just can't imagine that there would be much traction for those two candidates. And there may be another one coming, too.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No, Catherine. What can you tell us?
I can't tell you anything, but
I've
heard.
Burn the sources. I understand. Don't burn the sources. But I think the two candidates is the problem. I think if there was one candidate might could find an attraction, but both in the race is a bit too much to then, because that means pretty much Hank Johnson's going to make the runoff. And then it depends on how they position themselves. Interestingly enough, a story we're not going to get to cover very long is the murder rate dropped in a lot of counties around metro Atlanta, but DeKalb, it dropped a lot. And it's kind of funny, it dropped this past year when Vernon Jones wasn't in office. Connie Stokes was, even though she wasn't CEO. So,
well, let me just say, you got to be really careful with those numbers because they've messed around with those numbers a lot. They
dropped, Bolton dropped. It was good news. I mean,
right.
No,
I mean, it is good news,
that's
but you, right. But seriously, you have to be very careful about the way they do those numbers because I've looked at them before and it's like, the way they categorize things is not always the way you might imagine.
Yeah. Well, it's been a great show, and it has moved so quick. One little piece of homework. Go to MikeEvans.org. That's Mike Evans' campaign site before they take it down. I found it to be very confusing. The first picture is him with a lady and three kids and some other dude, and I was like, is this his family? And then I look down in the corner, and I see him with another lady and some other kids, and I assume this is his family, and I'm like, who's this random bunch of people? I've never seen a campaign website that appears to have a dude with two families. I guess people like David Fitter and Mark Sanford would be proud that this guy's living the dream in their eyes. But it's been the Kudzu Vine. Until next week, we'll see you then.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Bye.